This week's show is brought to you by Manscaped, who are the best in the business in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels and is trusted by over 2 million men worldwide. And having recently launched in the UK, you can be one of the first men to experience their products. They've recently redesigned the electric trimmer, also known as the Lawnmower 3.0, perfecting the greatest down-there trimmer ever created. Join the movement for all your below-the-waist grooming needs. Get 20% off and free delivery with the code WISDEN at manscaped.com. We've had some supplies sent to the office, and all I say, it does the job well. Anyway, on with the show.
One hit as well, yes. That was impressive. Deadpan.
England lose their first home test series in 7 years as a Black Caps side with six changes to it comfortably beat England at Edgbaston. We'll be talking about that test. The World Test Championship final, the England women's test at Bristol, the start of the T20 blast and more from the last week of cricket. There's also a new Wisden Cricket Monthly out, so we'll be previewing that. And we've also got a pre-recorded conversation between Phil and Lord Botham about the 81 Ashes that took place 40 years ago. Lots to get through as always. I'm Yaz Ryan, and with me today is former England batsman Mark Butcher, magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly Phil Walker. Let's start with the test match. New Zealand won it by 8 wickets, having bowled England out for not many in the second innings. We've had lots and lots of listener questions about this. I think listeners prefer it almost when England lose. Nick Beale asks, how can you fix the England test team? What is Sport asks, how can England improve their batting? Jamie Capper asks, any chance Butch could dust off his pads? But we had loads of questions about England's batting, but we also had this question from Billy Johnson, who asks, is there a massive overreaction to this series defeat and especially the batting? These past two games are the first times I can remember a real collapse from England in England under Silverwood, and they have shown they're capable of making big runs before. Joe, do you think that's broadly fair?
Well, it's interesting the point that Billy says in England, because it's hard to take this series in complete isolation from what's gone on over the winter. I mean, they are in different places, but this is another batting collapse to follow a lot of what we've seen. But I think we do find it shocking in home conditions when England looks so out of their depth against admittedly what's a very good side, but the Kiwis had made a lot of changes, and I think England fans have every right to feel aggrieved in lots of ways, to be honest. The fact that England didn't pick their best side in the first place, which we've obviously gone over ad nauseum, but then when you get thrashed like this, it's naturally going to come up again. The fact that England have got some very clearly very talented batsmen, for whatever reason, whether it's technique or approach, just don't seem to be able to do it consistently. So I don't think it is an overreaction, really. I think if England go on to beat India, then this New Zealand series will be relatively quickly forgotten. But I don't rate their chances particularly highly the way things are going at the moment. India will have obviously had a World Test Championship final to warm up for their series against England, and I think they have to go into that series as favourites now.
Mm. A point that a lot of people have made is that despite the rest in rotation, five of England's first choice top six did play that series. And I don't think it's been that long since people were quite optimistic about England's batting as well. The openers have been solid enough in the first choice team. You've got Root, Stokes, Butler in the middle, and Crawley and Pope are the two great young batting hopes, throwing Lawrence as well. But what do you think's happened with Pope in the last year or so? He looked the real deal in South Africa at the start of 2020, and runs, to be honest, I know his overall numbers for Surrey this season look really good, but I'm not that surprised by how he's gone for England. He's looked a bit frenetic at the crease. He's actually only passed 50 twice for Surrey this season. So what do you think's happened with Pope?
Good day, everybody. It's interesting because there are so many things at play here throughout the entire batting lineup, not just for somebody like Ollie Pope. Obviously, off the back of a winter where runs were so difficult to come by for all of that batting lineup, with the exception perhaps of Rory Burns, because he was pulled out of the firing line after the second Test match. Confidence is not particularly high, and you feel, particularly when you're starting out in Test match cricket, and the average is, you know, you're kind of hovering around the 30s or whatever, and you know, you feel as though there's a bit of pressure on you. You come off the back of a series where you haven't been able to score a run or show anything like what you can do, you're always feeling a bit under the pump. You run into a very, very good bowling attack in New Zealand in both Test matches. It doesn't go well. Also, a lot of the players, Pope in particular, Crawley also, who have played quite a bit of county cricket at the beginning of this summer, have all kind of fallen into this extraordinary vortex of batting on off stump, standing stock still as the ball is being released, and finding yourself having no idea where your orientation is, where your off stump is, playing at wide balls, missing straight ones, and not scoring any runs. So for that, you know, all players are responsible for their own technique. You make the decision as to how you want to set up, how you want to play, the type of backlift you want, all of these types of things. You have coaches to guide you and help you to make the best of that, but it is a player's responsibility over his technique and therefore his run scoring. They've decided that this is the way to go. I don't understand it. If you saw Nasser, he had a terrific rant at the end of the test match, something very much akin to what I was saying 2 weeks before here in the Surrey Middlesex game. And that's not working out particularly well. And it seems to be a disease that is afflicting batting right the way through English cricket in long form stuff. So that's another issue. In terms of an overreaction, it would be an overreaction had we all sort of thought, you know what, England are going into this in terrific shape. You know, all of the thinking is perfectly clear. You know, they should give New Zealand the run around because, you know, we haven't lost a series at home for 2014. And then suddenly this happens as a complete and utter shock and surprise. And everyone's kind of a bit, aggressive is not the right word, but a bit upset that, oh, you know, how could this possibly have happened? The reason the reaction is because we're all sat here for the last 3 weeks in the lead up to this going, this isn't going to go well. This is not going to go well. You know, the thinking behind selection, the thinking in terms of resting players, the thinking that if you do not have Ben Stokes in your team, you cannot pick a balanced side. It's not possible. The fact that you have all-rounders in Wokes and Moeen Ali, who for some reason, having played virtually no cricket whatsoever, could not have been brought in to try and balance out the team. The fact that somebody like Jack Leach is not trusted enough to hold an end in the first innings and bowl lots of overs and try and win you a game in the second. And granted, they would have had nothing to bowl at in this test match, all right? No problem. But the thinking, as far as everything goes, has led to the point where the reaction is not an overreaction. The reaction is, this was an accident waiting to happen. We've just watched it happen. And now you're in this bizarre position with a series coming up against India, where with so many unanswered questions, you're kind of like a little bit panicking as to what to do. You know, none of the top order are going to have any cricket, hardly any four-day cricket between now and that series starting. How do any of these guys go back and remedy the problems when they're playing T20 cricket or maybe making an appearance in the 100 or making appearances in that 50-over comp, whatever the hell that is? And so you think to yourself, well, India, if we manage to even nick a test match off India, the way things look at the moment, it will be extraordinary. And that is even with bringing in the likes of Ben Stokes and Josh Butler. God forbid something happens to Ben Stokes. God forbid Ben Stokes is unfit, does his back in before the first test against India, or something worse means he misses out on the Ashes, because apparently there is nothing you can do. Nothing can be done if Ben Stokes is not available to be selected to pick a balanced cricket team. Nothing.
Before you go on, magnificent start to a Tuesday morning, that. Bloody hell. You mentioned that a coach's role is to, you know, cajole and encourage and facilitate in the margins of it, but it's the player's responsibility to look after their technique, right? But a lot of people would have gone to Edgbaston this week and seen hordes and hordes and hordes of coaches, you know, doing everything from making the tea to getting on the bowling machine and the whole lot. Now, England's head batting coach isn't as good mate of yours, and a great cricketer and a good man and all of that. But people will be listening to this show and thinking, well, is there not a greater responsibility for the coaches to get hold of these players who are maybe garbling themselves by over-analysis? And if what Nasser said last week, and if what you said with Atherton and so on the week before that, if you're right, then if you're sharing a beer with Graham Thorpe, he would agree with you, because you know the game, you're of that era. Why is Graham Thorpe and Silverwood as well, and others, and their county coaches, why, if there's something fundamentally taking place here technically that shouldn't be from the top order down, why are they not being more proactive?
Well, we don't know that they're not. My guess is that they are, and they're making a very strong suggestion that perhaps you're not making life as simple for yourself as would be necessary, but that the player has to look. Can I make an example, right? And I don't do this in fact, I never do this, but I'm going to use myself as an example, right? Prior to a very, very jammy recall to the England side in 2001. I played 25, maybe 27 test matches, averaged 25, right? Made 200s, numbers not good enough, out of the team. No issue with that whatsoever. Then went in a spiral where I was out of the Surrey team and playing second team cricket and thinking about jacking the whole thing in, okay? I had a technique which had been serviceable up to a point but was, that was getting in my way. I had two choices. One was to quit because I was hating every second of it, and the other one was to do something about it. So I decided to do something about it. I called AR Butcher, technical coach par excellence as far as I'm concerned, and a lot of other people would agree with me, and said to him, treat me like I'm a baby. Treat me like I have never picked up a cricket bat before, right? And we stripped the whole thing back to nothing and started again. The reason and what he did was to make to give me the building blocks to do everything so simply that the movements and where I was positioned and my, where my balance was and where my weight was would not be something that would be getting in my way. It would be good deliveries, bad decision making, etc., etc. The technical side of it was to stay out of the way, and that was the simplicity of it all. So, and from that point, I got back in the side in 2001. I averaged 40 for the next 42 test matches, right? Batting at three for England. Okay? Ended up with an average of 34. And people will say, well, you know, average player, that's what the other England guys are doing. But I'm just illustrating what can be done technique-wise if you're open enough to it. So the question you asked about the responsibility of the coach is, the coach, my old man said to me, I'd wanted to change things for you for quite a long time before you made the call.
But he wouldn't want to go near you until you said.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Because we wouldn't have. I wouldn't have then given him the right amount of time to be able to do it. I mean, it wouldn't have been something where we were working together to reach the same goal. And that is what has to happen with the player. So it isn't. It's, and I hear this from cricketers, whether they be club cricketers or you know, international players, that in cricket, for some reason, batsmen in particular seem to have this idea that you have this way of playing and that's it. There's not much else you can do. Now, as from loving golf and from watching the best in somebody like Tiger Woods or any of these other guys, they are constantly changing their swing, moving things around, trying to find the sort of like the perfect, and perfect doesn't exist, by the way, but trying to find a way of doing something that is the most efficient that they can manage. And that's all. And what we are saying, and what the likes of us who don't play anymore, and this is not harping back to, you know, things were better in my day, because they weren't. There's no guarantee you're going to score runs even with the most perfect setup in the universe. But the point we're trying to make is this, is that international bowlers are bloody good. Test match cricket is bloody hard. So if you are starting off from a position where you're making life more difficult for yourself before the ball has even been bowled, right, your chances of success become fewer and fewer and fewer, less and less and less. And that is all. And all we're seeing is people tangling themselves up in knot. And then, you know, on the converse side of that, you see Devon Conway, never played a test match before, makes 200 on debut. Does anybody remember anything specifically about the way he played? No, because it was straightforward, basic, stand on middle and leg stump, get your body into a position where the bat can come down in a straight line and present the full face of the bat to the ball. That's it. And the guy who replaced the other right... Will Young. Same. Right? Nothing quirky about it. Nothing weird. Sideways on. Present the full face of the bat. You're in good shape. And that's all they did. You can't say that our boys can't bowl. You know, boys have got 1,300 test wickets between them. And they couldn't get them out.
But how much of it is just technique? So, If Pope starts batting on middle and leg next test match, that doesn't solve all of England's problems.
No, because you know you've got the confidence issue. Confidence is now at an all time low, which is where, you know, why I mentioned the India series beforehand. You kind of go into it and you feel like you're behind, so you kind of, you know, you're desperate to try and get a score on the board, and that desperation can turn into tension. That tension can turn into making errors. But again, you know, there was an argument that rages along the lines of, well, you know, it's not technique, it's, you know, it's what's going on in between the ears, it's mental, it's this, it's softness, whatever it might be. Again, I will use myself as an example again. When I knew my technique was working fine, my brain worked very, very well, thank you very much. Because you have less, you're not concerned about where you are, how you're feeling, your balance, you know where you're off. Everything is then on autopilot. All you have to do from there is watch the ball. So the idea that technique doesn't play any sort of part in bad form at all is ludicrous.
But with that in mind, then, is it not concerning to hear Thorpe? And, you know, he's facing the press after England got thrashed. It's a difficult job. You can't then just hammer your own batsman. But he said, this is an approach thing. This is a mental thing. This isn't a technique thing. And he even went on to say that the 100, if they play a few games in the 100 beforehand, that would be a good thing because it will free them up, which seemed like an odd thing.
Maybe.
To be saying, I mean, you obviously, you need to protect your players, and we see this with coaches in all sports. Absolutely. In all international sport, but we're journalists, but we're also fans, and we've watched England very badly.
He's not going to tell you. He's not going to tell you what he's telling them.
No, but I think a lot of fans would like to hear some kind of recognition that things aren't right at the moment. I think people would have kind of respect for that, but there is a sense that there's almost a bit of denial in the way that the batsmen are playing and in the way the coaching staff are talking.
Yeah, potentially there could be. I mean, we won't know because, you know, we assume that there are no conversations going on behind closed doors to remedy either technical failings or failings of any other sort. And I can guarantee you that won't be the case. I mean, there is nothing worse. I mean, nothing worse than kind of going away from a cricket ground, having, you know, with 2 days left of the test match, knowing that fans are kind of have missed out on their day's entertainment, knowing that you've lost a game, knowing that you're going to get hammered in shows like this for the next 3 or 4 days. It's terrible. And so you're looking for solutions to that all of the time. I mean, you know, there's a question that hasn't been asked just yet, and that is, you know, are these guys the right guys? As far as Ollie Pope's concerned, I think absolutely yes. As far as Zach Crawley's concerned, if you asked me this last summer, I'd have said absolutely yes. You know, it's another one of those picks, you know, on talent as opposed to on numbers. But he seems to have got himself so tied up in knots technically that mentally he's got no chance either. Dom Sibley and Rory Burns, you know, that they're not everybody's cup of tea. And
I think they get grouped together a little bit harshly as well, those two, because they are quixotic looking players. Yeah. But there is daylight, I think, between the two of them. And if we go back technically again, look at Burns. There is a flow to his game. There's a lot going on beforehand, as we know, but there is a flow to his game. He can play perpendicular shots when it's in at the bodies. He's added that to his game. If anything, that second innings, that disastrous shot that he played first up, that was, if anything, a consequence of his confidence, you know, overconfidence, that he was feeling good in his game.
He's one of the guys that I would say, Rory Burns, where I'd say that sort of mentally, his kind of, that's his issue is kind of, you know, not getting too far ahead of himself and kind of, you know, being as patient as he was in the first innings. I'd agree with that 100%. 100%. Sibley, on the other hand, is another one where you could sort of say, wow, I mean, how long are you going to last kind of playing like that?
Yeah.
You know, having to face 150 balls to get 40, you're kind of, you know, you're making life very, very tough for yourself.
And he
but he does have, and this is kind of to back up Silverwood and the selectors a little bit. Remember where his selection appeared from. His selection appeared from 30 for 4 every game. You know, so there is a reason behind having somebody who has a sort of like the mental capacity to grind out for long periods of time. Yeah. And look, so I would love it. I'd prefer it if Dom Sibley were Graham Gooch, obviously. But at the moment, you kind of got what you've got.
You do, but you also have other players in the wings. And the thing with Sibley...
Go on, then.
Well, I mean, Hamid was in the squad. Hamid and Kane Williams had a 20-minute conversation on the outfield after the game, and I saw him in the nets, and he's obviously scored a lot of runs this year. It might be too early for him, come what may. But just going back to Sibley briefly, and I don't want to kind of target him necessarily, but this notion that he's not everyone's cup of tea, he's only got one way of playing, but he does a job for England, that may be the case from tomorrow, but it's not really been the case up to now. He's made something like 9 or 10 single-figure scores in his last 18 or 19 innings. So this idea that he's a one-paced kind of player, but he sees off the cherry and allows the stroke makers in the afternoon, that's not really happening either a lot of the time. He's unable to get through the new ball, let alone develop his innings when the ball gets a little bit softer. So... He's given everything he's got, Sibley. He has this homespun technique, which is right on the edges of workability, isn't it? And if there's one thing that's slightly off, then the bat is coming from out there, and he's late on it some of the time. And you saw it in that second innings. That delivery from Matt Henry was not an absolute jaffer. All right, held its line. But it's just a straight up and down ball outside off stump. Now, either you leave it or you cover it. This is not boomeranged away from him. And yet the bat was coming down through so many different sort of peculiar angles and wends its way around the back roads before finally coming down. And he's too late on it, so he nicks off. Same applies when there's a long half volley outside off stump. He has to come through so many different avenues to get there. And while he has immense concentration and cussedness, and he's a really likable bloke as well, and I understand why England fans want a Sibley-esque player to work, but my concern, having watched him for 2 years, is that he's not quite the player to fulfil the role that he's rightly put in place for.
I completely get that. But I do think his record in England is pretty good. Those numbers look very bad because that included that winter tour that went badly for most of them. And I guess part of the whole discussion in England batsmen is kind of just what you just asked. Who's outside this team? Who's banging down the door?
I would love to see Hamid in it. I would love to
see straight?
That.
So for the India series?
I would love to see that.
Interesting.
But this this is the problem. We're talking, reading the papers over the last few days, that the two saviours of England's best test batting lineup are Hamid, who until very recently had scored 100 in 4.5 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And David Malan, who has had 15 test matches, got an Ashes 100, but is averaging below 30. He's about to turn 34 and has only played 4 first-class games since the start of last season. I mean, I think Malan is probably worth another look. He's got a kind of bloody-mindedness that I think will serve him potentially quite well in Test cricket. He's got an Ashes 100, which is potentially very useful at this point in terms of selection questions. And even though it's a completely different format, he's shown he's got the bottle for international cricket. He's done well in T20 cricket. That said, I don't think he's going to change anything dramatically. I still think England have got more or less the best side. It's just not working.
Mm.
And I think I completely take Phil's point on Sibley, and you watch him and you think this isn't going to work, and then he'll pull out an innings just as you're kind of losing faith to think, well, we'll give him another shot. But crucially as well, are we prepared to jump back on the merry-go-round? He was scoring so many more runs than anyone else in county cricket. We've tried pretty much all the other openers who have also largely lost form. If you look at someone like who hasn't been tried yet, Gubbins, not pickable at the moment. Stoneman's obviously lost form. There aren't a vast amount of options out there. And I thought an interesting name, which I thought about quite a lot over the last few days, is someone like Joe Clark, who scored a magnificent T20 100 only a few days ago and is the most talented non-capped English batsman in the country, I would say. Clearly a huge talent. But this is a guy who scored 6 first-class 100s in his second year of first-class cricket as a teenager. I think over the last 4 years, he's averaging 32, 33. So how... And this is obviously a broader question. How is Joe Clark now, at least going by numbers, a worse first-class red ball batsman now than he is when he came through? Everyone will have their theories on county cricket pitches. Is it his focus is now on white ball cricket? But he told Phil in an interview only a few months ago that Test cricket is where he wants to be, that he feels ready to play it. Well, his numbers suggest otherwise.
Mm. His recent T20 record is ridiculous. He's striking at near enough 200. But I think that is quite interesting. We were talking about this before we started recording, that if you're the eighth or ninth best red ball batsman in the country, you're a county player, you're not in the England team. If you're the eighth or ninth best white ball batsman in the country, you're making a lot of money in leagues around the world. That must come into it, surely, if you're a player on the outside of the England setup.
It does. But the other side of it is that young English batsmen play more first-class red ball cricket than any of their counterparts around the world by miles. And there's a lot of crap thrown at the system, and there is always that understandable response to a humiliating defeat. Humiliating 2 weeks, really, when you think about the Lord's Day 5 as well, which I know you boys spoke about last week. It's been a bad 2 weeks on and off the pitch for English cricket, no doubt. And there's an understandable response. I get that. Look at the system. Look at the way that the schedules have been squeezed, and red ball cricket has been deprioritised, arguably, and so on and so on. I just want to give you a quick example: Henry Nicholls and Dan Lawrence, right, batting in the same position, five and six. Henry Nicholls debuted 5 years, first class debut 5 years before Dan Lawrence. He's 6 years older than Dan Lawrence. Dan Lawrence is 23 and a bit. Nicholls is 29. They've played the same amount of first-class cricket, bar 2 games. Dan Lawrence is 2 games shy of Henry Nicholls. Henry Nicholls bats like a cussed, gnarly test match batsman, as if he's been playing forever and a day. And Dan Lawrence is this kind of greenhorn maverick kid that may or may not crack it and so on, and is somehow some sort of product spat out of our system where we're obsessed with white ball cricket and we don't give red ball cricket any respect, etc., etc. Dan Lawrence has already played 88 first class games by the age of 23, right? So this notion that we just throw him to the wolves is not backed up by the facts and the figures. It's just not there. And if you talk to Lawrence, just to pick him out as an example, he said, as I said to you on the show before, Red Bull cricket, that's where, for me, my money is. That's where my head is. That's where my career is. Red Bull cricket, Red Bull cricket. And that's his priority. And it's borne out by the numbers. He's played far more Red Bull games than he has white ball games. He's 23 years old.
And if you get an England test match contract, you're on £750,000.
Yeah, and Red Bull cricket is Crawley's priority. It's Pope's priority. I don't think that might be an issue in terms of the number of players coming through. I don't think it's the issue in terms of the players who've actually got in the side.
But some do. And there's been a lot of pieces written and comments made in the last few days that allude to that, that we're not giving these lads any chance of proper success because we've turned everything around and all the traditions of English cricket have been rejected and inverted. Well, I don't see that in the numbers.
Mm. We've talked about the test quite a lot, but a couple of other players I wanted to talk about briefly. Crawley is an interesting one. I think people who work in cricket probably have quite a different view on him to people who don't, I think, in that his numbers don't leap off the page. He averages 31 in first-class cricket now, over 60-odd games, 29 in test cricket and 25 in first-class cricket this summer. His dismissal in the first innings really wasn't great. I thought hinted at a kind of frazzled mind. What do you think's happening there? And do you think would you play him in the first test against India? There's very little cricket between now and that first test, a couple of rounds of the championship and a lot of blast cricket. But would you keep him in?
I thought his first innings, his very brief first innings, was quite shocking, actually, just to see how frazzled his mind had got. And especially when you contrast it to what we saw last summer. The thing is, the anomaly in his career so far is that innings last summer. You say his numbers don't leap off the page. Well, they're starting to, but in the wrong way. I mean, he has had a horrible trot in test cricket. And if you don't have the weight of runs in first-class cricket to fall back on in the way that Sibley does, Pope does, Lawrence does, Crawley doesn't have that record. So, I mean, I still think he will have a successful test career, but I think there's probably more work to be done outside of the test team before he gets that point. So if I was to lose one of the current batting lineup, I would actually lose him before Sibley.
To take him out of the firing line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Crawley will end up playing more test matches than Sibley by the end of their career, but based on the evidence that I saw at Edgbaston, I think Crawley could probably do with a breather.
And a question related to kind of the struggles of the young players, James DeMello asked, would it benefit Pope and Lawrence to be given a run in the ODI side of the next 6 weeks and get more international cricket under their belts? Obviously, they're neither are that close to the ODI side at the moment, but...
Who's going to run that one past Owen Morgan?
That's a very good question. It's a very good question. But given that there's not that much cricket left for the start of that India series...
What was his name?
James.
James. I would imagine, James, given that England could not find a way of trying to fit in Chris Wokes or Moeen Ali to a test side to try and win a test match, that the likelihood of them doing that to their one day side is next to non-existent. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure it would be that much help either, to be honest.
Could it actually be a hindrance if we saw what happened to Bairstow's test career
I don't think it'd be a hindrance, but I just don't think it'd make a massive amount of difference. I mean, these guys are going to play, once they're not playing in the test matches, they're going to be playing blast and 100 cricket, aren't they?
Sorry, was this the question regarding
where they play
ODI? And the thought experiment, yeah. Pope and Lawrence,
and the way that England want to play their one day cricket is not to give people a net. You know, they want to go out there and score 300 plus every time they go out and bat. So I would say that's for lots of reasons. I mean, it's an idea. It's something that they might have done. You know, might have done in the old Texaco Trophy days when white ball cricket wasn't of any importance.
Undoubtedly, back those days.
Yeah, but not now.
But the, I guess an additional point to that is that, you know, I just picked Lawrence because Essex only have the one game. He's got two innings until the next test match in, what, 5 weeks? 5 or 6 weeks?
Yeah, long, yeah.
August.
Yeah,
early August. So he's got two hits against a Red Bull. Now, while the majority who are following county cricket have really enjoyed the 2 month condensed period and thought that it's really given the championship an extra bit of oomph and narrative and so on that we can really get with. The flip side is that now, going into the big bit of the summer, Red Bull cricket internationally, where are you going to get your practice in, right?
And
this is problematic, right?
Bumped into a few of the players over the last week, going round after the blast, and the bowlers, as you'd expect in particular, are absolutely hanging after playing 8-9 championship games in 8-9 weeks. Absolutely hanging. So, you know, I've kind of enjoyed it, but formatting-wise, but in terms of scheduling, it's a disaster. It's a disaster for lots of reasons. Obviously, that being one, player fatigue, bowler fatigue. And also the fact that you're just not going to play any championship. I mean, we had this, I think might have been my first pod. You know, you get the conditions change throughout the course of an English summer, and English batsmen are not going to get the chance to bat at the best time of the summer.
I think we could do a whole pod on county cricket scheduling.
June, July, August. You know, that's where you cash in, yeah. And they're not going to get a chance to bat in it. So it's a mess.
Just a couple of other final points on England. I think it's quite interesting that Root's struggles is probably the wrong word, but for quite a long time now, he averages about 33 in home tests over 3.5 years now, which is quite a long time. And I think that's kind of gone under the radar given the struggles of everyone else. And
it's the elephant in the room, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have to be honest.
Quite a long time. And that his return to form, in inverted commas, at the start of the year, 3 massive 100s, they're in completely different conditions, exclusively against spin. And I don't think you can read anything from those innings in terms of how he will go for the rest of this summer. And the Ashes, unfortunately. He didn't have that great a start to the county championship season either.
I bet you that, I mean, being at home, being the England captain at home comes with a heck of a lot more extraneous and external responsibilities than it does when you're away from home.
A man of experience for a week.
No, but it does.
And also, but particularly over the last couple of weeks, I mean, I felt very sorry for him in this test match. He can't have been going out with a clear mind. He's apt to deal with some incredibly difficult questions, which I thought actually handled really well in the lead up. It's a mess, and very little of it, or perhaps none of it, is his own doing.
He's not had his best team in a year, is he? Pretty much.
We talked about an interview he did, was it with the Daily Mail, where he said, "I hope we never have the situation overseas again." But that's about it. I think he's done. It says a lot about him as a bloke that he's managed to kind of keep a lid on this, because it's probably counterproductive to throw his toys out of the pram, but I wouldn't blame him if he did.
But when just in brackets, we don't need to go back to technique. Joe has been playing around with his technique so much again in the last year or two. I happened to catch, what was it, 2015, when Broad bowled Australia out in an hour, and then Root made the most amazing 120 at Trent Bridge on day one when the ball was meant to be going around corners. And it was so pure, and it was so rhythmical, and it was so beautiful. And compare and contrast that when the world was opened up to him, you know, and everything was beautiful and he had no pressure on his shoulders and he could just go out and play. Compare that to the innings on Saturday afternoon, which was the most forlorn Joe Root innings I can ever remember. 1-4 in 60-odd, no kind of natural rhythm, no flow, no anything. And you could sense just the colour just draining out of him, you know, and he dragged himself off after nicking off, and it just felt like a sort of doleful Joe Root, which is in complete polar contrast to that impish, brilliant kid that we saw just a few years ago.
The numbers back that up as well.
The job takes its toll, right?
He averaged 60 at home up until the end of his first year as captain, and averages 32 since. Both with quite large sample sizes now. And one other point I just wanted to make, and we don't need to have a discussion on it. We've talked about the rest and rotation policy a lot. I did think it was a bit sad almost that you had that full house who was obviously loving it and you didn't have your best available team there. And I know we've talked about the ins and outs of the rest and rotation policy to death on this show, but I thought it was a great shame that you had pretty much a full house for the first time in nearly 2 years. And you didn't have the best available team when you had someone from New Zealand in Trent Bolt who'd gone from the IPL to New Zealand straight into a test match.
And Chris Wokes lives 8 miles up the road.
Exactly.
In St. Caulfield.
Yeah. Did you see Harmy had
T20.
A, Yeah. Steve Armisen had a superb rant that I caught on Twitter last night saying exactly that. So
right.
He's flown 10,000 miles to come back and represent his country, and Chris Wokes is 10 miles up the road with his feet up.
And desperate to play.
Yeah, and desperate to play, yeah. Yeah. And desperate to play.
It's not his
fault. But think again, but we've had this conversation before the series started. This is, again, why the reaction is not an overreaction. All of these things were brought up in terms of kind of respecting the test matches, respecting the fans, all of these things. And so, you know, is what it is. Mm. It's not as though we haven't called it that this was likely to happen.
One last thing. 2014, the last time England lost a series at home.
Sri Lanka.
So, you know, before we all just turn off our mics and jump over that balcony, let's just bear that in mind as well, I suppose.
That's a very fair point. Very fair point. We should probably talk about the team that won the game, New Zealand. Obviously very impressive again. But
brilliant.
Probably the most striking thing is how they had six changes to that side, and Matt Henry comes in, Will Young comes in, Ajaz Patel comes in, and they look very good straight away. We'll talk a little bit about the World Test Championship later on the show. But that is a side with a fraction of the resources that England has.
So what do they do? Okay, not talking about their domestic league. I'm not talking about, you know, how their players play anymore. What do they do when they replace players? They bring in people who do a job like for like. So it's not a question of, you know, we're going to complain that we now can't balance the team because one individual is going. If we lose an opening batsman, we bring in an opening batsman. If we lose a wicketkeeper batsman, we bring in a wicketkeeper batsman. If we're going to have a spin bowling option, we replace him with another like for like spin bowling option. We lose our pace bowler or two, we replace them with a like for like pace bowler, right? So they have an idea about the type of cricket that they want to play and the type of personnel that they need to be able to play it, and then they replace them. They bring in people who do the same thing so that they can maintain the way that they want to play and have options open to them throughout the course of the 5 days. What do? We lose one guy and the entire thing goes up in smoke. Yeah. You cannot play a balanced team anymore because you lost one bloke. They lost six. Six!
I was imagining if Will Young was English and played that role, you can just imagine that media reaction, like England's Ashes host.
We'd be winning.
Six people, Dave. Six.
Yeah. And also, imagine being... New Zealand are most likely not going to play Will Young in the World Test Championship final. Imagine being in a position where you can...
Or Henry, he won't play either.
Exactly, yeah.
Just briefly, on those as well, though. You know, Nicholls plays one-day cricket, Black Caps cricket. Yeah. Williamson, obviously. Taylor, Latham. They all play... They all play that format as well, right? So this is not that they've kind of siphoned off the test match players and said, that's all you do. They've looked at the full landscape and all the resources, and they've expertly organised that around their schedules to ensure that they can produce brilliance now. And it's not plucky quality, it's brilliance. You know, that was a serious cricket team. It deserves more credit than it gets. But then it's understandable that when you look at a defeat like that, then that's what you focus on. But for one team to play badly, another team's got to play well, and they were, at times, they were absolutely brilliant. In Conway, I mean, where can that kid go? You know, I'm not getting carried away here. I don't think I've seen a more technically sound start to a test career. And yeah, I mean, the 80 odd he made, which I was up there and I saw it, that's as good an 80 odd technically as you can imagine.
And also, if you're going to get out, what a way to get out.
What a way to go. called deep square with the
Did you
see
the interview on it afterwards?
No,
he was,
I didn't.
He was asked about it, and he basically said, yeah, probably hit it better than I imagined. We didn't mean to hit it in the air. So
this is what they're doing. They are now bringing in quality as well. Jameson as well. You know, in previous eras, New Zealand would, if you lose two or three, then you bring in workman-like cricketers in the slipstream. But
we're saying how can England's red ball batsmen possibly find form when they haven't got any games before the India series? Well, Conway, before the Lord's Test, hadn't played a red ball game since March. So, I mean, it is achievable. Yeah. It's not just practice, is it?
Absolutely it is. Hey, I'll read you something, right? Let's have a look. Devon Conway's coach, right? A guy called... surname's Pocknell. Glenn Pocknell. Here we go. He was asked, did he make any technical changes to suit the standard of test match batting? And he said, oh, yeah, we made one small change. The way he prepared himself in terms of his feet movement facing up to the bowler, did some research on Kohli, Root, De Villiers, etc. He said he looked at their position at release when the bowler was bowling the ball, and we looked at his position at release and discussed that and came to the conclusion that it needs to be slightly different. We just changed his feet position and changed his trigger. So basically, he was giving himself more time once the ball was delivered. Prior to that, and this is the kicker, prior to that, he was standing still on the crease. And look, he was still a great batsman, don't get me wrong, but by making this small change, he gave himself more time. What do the England batters do? What are they talking about? What is this change in technique? Not only are they taking a middle and off stump guard, but they're standing stock still. No rhythm. The ball comes out and suddenly you're in a rush because you've not started moving yet, or you haven't moved soon enough. I remember Nick Compton struggling with that with the series that he got left out of the side. I think it might have been against New Zealand, funnily enough. Getting nailed on the crease, standing in front of all three stumps, standing stock still until the ball was delivered. So the thing that Devon Conway changed from first-class cricket, where he was scoring an absolute mountain of runs, by the way, to test match cricket, was just to move a little bit sooner, get himself a trigger position, get a little bit of rhythm into his batting, move before the ball is coming. And that was something that we all talked about back in the day. Do not be caught stock still when the ball is on the way out of the bowler's hand, because you will be late. You will not be fast enough. You will end up playing around your front pad. You'll end up missing the damn thing, right? That's what he said, and that's how many runs he scored. By doing something that would have been sort of second nature to batsmen of a different era. So you heard it from the horse's mouth.
Absolutely.
Technique matters.
Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Well, being up there and been in a commentary box for a few days with Jeremy Coney. Has to be. I mean, where do you start? I mean, it's probably ironic that I'm lost for words because he never is, my word. He has, I don't know, a facility with language that is untouched, really, in our game. Even Norcross has to bow down to him from time to time, which doesn't come easily for the old boy. Jeremy Coney kind of sort of drifts through commentary boxes when called upon, and always elevates them whenever he's there. And the BBC have him over, of course, for the New Zealand leg of this summer, and he'll be doing the World Test Champs. But I was jammy enough to be in a commentary box next to him, working for another organisation out in Australia, New Zealand and so on. And he honoured us with a bit of his time. And yeah, you just sort of stand there. And I mean, I'm quite sort of tired and weathered of this job most of the time. But every now and then you do have a moment that elevates it from the humdrum. And to share a broom cupboard in 30-degree heat with a crappy little fan in the corner with Jeremy Coney, that was a moment where, yeah, I did actually take a bit of time to think, right, yeah, there are worse things to do in life, you know. And he was just magical. I know. Poor me.
That is lovely.
But yeah, I mean, the line that always sticks out with me about Coney, John Surtees, who works here at the Oval, he's a Surrey head of communications or whatever, and he heard that Coney might be around this summer, and he said, look, when Messi comes on the market, you got to buy it and you got to move quick. So I think you'll be hearing a bit more of Coney for English or British audiences this summer via Surrey, hopefully. But yeah, he's the doyen of doyens.
Wonderful. England have named a T20I squad for the Sri Lanka Series 8 this summer. It's pretty much full strength, which isn't what Morgan predicted earlier in the year. There's no Stokes and Archer through injury. There are a few interesting recalls. David Willey's back in the side. Chris Wokes, who's not played for England in T20I cricket since 2015, is back. He had a couple of good games in the IPL before that was postponed. And Liam Dawson's back. There is no Matt Parkinson. And I wonder what he needs to do to get into that squad. He's got 87 wickets at under 16 in T20 cricket, an economy of just over 7. We've talked about it loads. We don't need to go into it now. But I do wonder if Adil Rashid gets an injury just before a World Cup in India.
Rashid in that squad?
He's in that squad. But as in, if he gets an injury, you want Matt Parkinson to have more games in him before then.
It's kind of willfully pragmatic, isn't it, to say, you know, Dawson is our left arm spinner, we have our wrist spinner, and so be it.
I just don't think it is pragmatic. Like, if Rashid picks up an injury just before the tournament, very, very few T20 sides don't have a wrist spinner in there. And Parkinson's not played that much international cricket. And for as well as he's done recently for Lancashire, you kind of want him exposed to international cricket.
There could be an element.
There's nothing on that series
far,
as well.
Far be it from me to kind of back up the selection, but there could be an element of Dawson very, very unlikely to play. Rather than Parkinson carry the drinks, we'd rather him knocking people over left, right and centre for Lancashire in the Blast. That might be the... Because I looked at that and thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. But then Rashid and Ali are going to play. The chances are that Parkinson might have spent another month or so of his career running around making drinks for other people. So that might not be quite as bad, you know, just to placate the Lancashire fans. I know they're very, very angry about this. But that might be the reasoning behind that.
That is a valid point for sure. The T20 Blast, that kicked off this week. A reminder that you can still sign up for our fantasy game, the Cricket Draft, powered by Wisden at fantasy.wisden.com. There's a prize for the winner of each individual game week. So if you've not signed up, you can still win prizes. But you've watched more of it than anyone else in the world. What the highlights been for you so far?
There've been some really good stuff actually on the TV. So you had the champions blow up spectacularly to tie a game against Worcestershire at New Road in Sky's opening game. And Ross Whiteley kind of was a big part of that. He probably went under the radar a bit, but he caught an absolute stunner of a catch out deep mid-wicket diving forward, which kind of turned the game round in Worcestershire's favour on that particular night. So that was pretty special. He then did it again on Friday night at Northampton. Will Jacks played an absolute brute of an innings. Well, actually, I say brute. I mean, the hitting was brutal, but it was very pretty as well. You know, the six over extra cover up into the grandstand was something of rare magnificence.
Properly threatened the record for the quickest Blast 100 as well.
Yeah, he was 15 balls for the 50, wasn't it? Yeah. And it took an extraordinary run out from none other than Paul Sterling at backward point, Jonty Sterling, to get rid of him. So that was pretty. And Tom Curran actually back to a bit of form bowling at the death, albeit, you know, slightly different bowling at the back end of Middlesex's 11 to international cricket, but even so, he's looked pretty good. But my moment of the week has got to be a lad playing who wasn't born when the Blast started back in 2003.
Wow. First Blast baby.
First Blast baby. Neil Lennam's son.
Pin. Ah, is that what it is?
That's right. Pin Lennam, who so-called because he was sort of very thin and had a head a little bit like a pinhead, but also because his fingers were always pinned together. He hardly ever played opening batsman for Sussex, top lad. But his son Archie, at a tender age of 16 and three quarters, made his debut on TV. His first touch dropped an absolute sitter at backward point. It was just an absolute sitter. And the only excuse I can come up with was that, you know, it was kind of like adult's kit. So maybe his hat slipped over his ears and the peak obscured his eye because he was just like the tiniest little thing. And then the very next over, he was brought onto bowl. He took a wicket with his first ball.
And his celebration was lovely, wasn't it?
Yeah, skipping around like an April lamb or something. It was brilliant. He took three for 14, man of the match. It was pretty special.
And another 16-year-old as well at Sussex. We talked Dan Ibrahim the week before.
Yeah, I'd suppose Ian Salisbury said that, you know, they've thrown him in. They've got the backing. He and James Kirtley are sort of sharing coaching duties. So Salis is responsible for the 4-day side and Kirtley the T20 team. And they've said, you know, they both said, you know, it's going to be tough. Perhaps not so much in the T20 because they look a bloody good side to me. Phil Salt was dynamite as well. But in the 4-day stuff, it's going to be tough. But their average age for their 4-day team in the championship is 23-24, I think. So that they've got the backing of the club to kind of do that, and you know the cards will fall where they may, and you know who knows, in 2 or 3 years' time they might reap some dividends from it.
Absolutely. Surrey and Kent are 3 from 3 in the South Group. Durham are unbeaten in the North Group. I actually watched the Notts Worcester game from the first day was on in the pub that I was at. And it was really interesting how everyone was glued to the finish. And like, I was with 5 mates who aren't really into cricket, but they know who Moeen Ali is, probably don't know who Alex Hales is, but everyone was gripped and just made me think, how has T20 cricket not been on free-to-air TV at one point in the last 18 years? I think if you actually show people what a finish to a T20 game is, it was like if you're in a pub and they had like a Carabao Cup game on and no one's really paying attention, and then it goes to penalties and everyone's suddenly watching it. It was kind of like that. Everyone was gripped, and I thought, yeah, people should have been watching this stuff a long, long time ago.
Good game.
Amazing game. Absolutely amazing game. The England Women's Test that we talked about last week, that starts tomorrow at Bristol. The England squad has been trimmed from 17 to 15. Sarah Glenn and Freya Davies, the two to drop out. The 15 includes Emily Arlott, who we talked about on last week's show. She took a hat-trick in the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy.
Proper action, that.
Yeah, it's just, she's a
proper fast bowler action.
23-year-old seamer who seems to have caught the eye, and according to various reports, actually looks quite likely to play in a test match as well. She gave some nice quotes after a call-up. She said, "I'm probably as shocked as anyone that I got the call. I didn't even think my name was as in contention to be considered." The that gets underway tomorrow, and we'll react to it on next week's show. Elsewhere, there is a test match, a test series currently taking place that forms part of the current World Test Championship cycle. So South Africa-West Indies, the second test of that series will probably actually finish after the World Test Championship final, which is quite funny. In the first,
that sums up the whole thing, yeah, though,
doesn't it? Really? It does, isn't it?
They need us to take over, Joe.
Yeah, we're about to get there. South Africa beat West Indies by an innings in the first test of that two-game series. There were fifers for Norkia Rabada and Ngidi, and there's a debut from my boy Jaden Seals, the 19-year-old West Indian. Only played one first-class cricket before his debut. He took a three for. On his debut.
That's a proper three, that, isn't it? Norkia, Rabada, and Ngidi. That's a serious, serious new ball attack, mate.
Decent guess. I hope you've put a COVID contingency into your plan that's coming up, by the way.
This is pure utopia.
I know. That's the reason why this game is finishing after the final.
Of course,
Fair
point. Fair point.
The World Test Championship final obviously gets underway this week. We've talked a little bit about New Zealand, But Butch, how do you see that final going? New Zealand obviously with a couple of tests under the belt,
good performances,
a lot of players in form. It's going to be quite hard to pick an 11.
Don't underestimate the value of that, for sure. India are playing a couple of intra squad games, etc., or have played intra squad games, and they're kind of, you know, I don't know how much of they're good for getting acclimatised, really, but they're not sort of as battle hardening as getting through 30, 40 overs in a test match might be or whatever. However, when you look at the squad, the players they've brought over, boy, they've got some skill in that side. And I suppose, as far as New Zealand is concerned, their bowling attack, you'd be thinking to yourself, you know, you could very easily catch India's top six cold. Don't forget, you know, England. We talked about England's batting woes. India's batsmen, with the exception of Rohit and Rishabh Pant, did not fare a great deal better than England's did in the last series. So confidence-wise, you know, somebody like Ajinkya Rahane is under quite a lot of pressure. He's their go-to man away from home, isn't he? Captain the team to victory in Australia, etc. Made 100 at Melbourne, but still, his numbers have been declining and declining and declining, and he had a rotten old time of it in the Test series against England. I think he averaged 16 or 17. Shubman Gill, unbelievably talented, the top of the order. With Rohit, but again, it's kind of very, very green, if you'll pardon the pun, when it comes to playing opening batting here in the UK. Pujara, obviously, we all know about him, terrific player. So, I mean, they've got skill like you wouldn't believe. Kohli will be desperate to come over here and show, you know, that his troubles against the moving ball in the UK are beyond him, although, you know, the last time India were here, he showed how classy he is. So they've got fantastic batters, who perhaps might have appreciated a little bit more of a lead up. On the fast bowling side, Bumrah, Ishant, Shami, they've got Siraj, who was so very impressive, Shardul Thakur, Umesh Yadav. So they've got all the bases covered, and it will just depend on whether or not they feel they need to play four and one, or whether they might go three and two. I suspect they might go three and two, Southampton. Not seeing the pitch, guessing a little bit, but whether we've had, you would imagine that they might think to themselves, you know what, we can certainly, with Ashwin and Jadeja both fit and available to play, we'd play both of those and we'll pick our best three out of the three quicks.
Pant six, Jadeja seven, Ashwin eight, pick your three quicks.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's how I might go. But you know, again, we haven't seen the surface. We don't know what sort of state physically everybody is in. But they're gonna be able to pick an absolute belter of a team. In fact, the only guys that they're really missing, who are pretty much on the outside anyway, would be Sahar and Kale Raoul, who were awaiting fitness tests. So they've got everything that they could possibly want to pick from. But I still think that New Zealand have the edge, simply because of the type of cricket they play at home and the fact that they've just had two test matches. I mean, you know, New Zealand have used England as a warm-up for a World Test Championship.
That's
exactly what's happened.
I saw people cheekily suggesting that New Zealand should have followed India's suit by playing themselves to get a competitive warm-up for the series.
I can't wait for this.
Yeah,
I'm so looking forward to it.
Yeah.
It's amazing because I was thinking New Zealand big favourites, but then when Butcher's reading out their team,
that is quite
a good team. And I think you've always got to take into account there'll be some sort of unforeseen event that denies New Zealand at the last, even though they've entirely dominated the game as well.
Yeah, but India never win these global tournaments either, so someone's got to win it.
Actually, it could be a draw.
They're going to share the trophy for the race 3 days.
You know, and the other side to all of this,
Forecast generally isn't very good.
What we will see as well, I should imagine, for all those people who are kind of still disbelieving of the idea of a sort of like, you know, batting technique and whatever, is two top sixes who are kind of as orthodox as it gets, really. You know,
that is a very good point,
aren't they? I mean, they're just, you know, Rohit is as good a technician as there is. He might, again, his failures might come from, you know, deciding that he wants to hit the third ball of the innings for six back over the bowler's head or whatever, but it's nothing to do with his general method of play, forward, back, bat straight.
Yeah, and they even from, say, someone like Tom Latham, who's sort of kind of with faint praise described as like a nuggety left-hander. When Tom Latham wants to play a straight drive, everything is absolutely perfect, and the flow of the bat speaks for itself. He's on the furthest side of the story, really. And then you look at,
Lead us back down this road again. Sorry.
No. All right. You can cut this. But he's right. He's right.
Bang on.
The 12 batsmen that we'll see are all pretty old school style players.
Joe, how do you pick an 11 for New Zealand? They've got 17 men who are in pretty good form.
There's a lot of 50-50 calls, but that shows a pretty good side, doesn't it? I think the batting lineup, I think, is almost like kind of take your pick. I think Will Young might well miss out despite having batted so well at Edgbaston. I think you've got I like the Grantham Mitchell choice, who are kind of almost exactly the same player that they can go for. I think De Grantham probably wins that one. I think Patel, the spinner, plays.
You've got one of the gun seamers if you play De Grantham and Patel.
You do, don't you?
Yeah.
I was going to go and pick 12.
Yeah.
Whereas you're going to pin me down to an exact 11.
Yeah, it's like picking an England front three in football. You're like, oh, Grealish's got to play, Foden's got to play, Sterling's got to play, but then you can't pick.
Yeah, I genuinely
players.
Don't know.
Henry almost certainly misses out.
Yeah.
I think that's...
So you've got Jameson,
Wagner, Bolt, Salby. If you play De Grandhomme and Patel, you can't pick all four. Simon Dool on commentary said he'd drop Wagner, which...
Really,
is bold, but to be honest, like a very good cricketer is not gonna
well,
play.
Depends. If you back Jameson to be able to do a job at what, 7, then you could potentially get away without playing De Grandhomme. But that's he hasn't shown quite enough yet to be a Test number 7. Yeah.
But you could.
I think Wagner doesn't play.
Do you think so?
Yeah,
I think he will play.
I think he misses out.
Okay,
I think
he's played two and two as well.
I don't think they're gonna see the need to play two left arm quicks. And so it'll be Jameson, Bolt, Saudi.
God, that's a tough call on him, isn't it? Given what he's done over the last...
I think so. But then they've not had all of the others to pick from all at once, have they, in recent times?
Mm. Yeah. The one thing I would say is that they quite often don't pick a specialist spinner at home where the pitches are quite flat. And I know Patel bowled very well, but I can kind of see them not picking Patel.
Yeah, right. This is what I was going to suggest. Right. And I was talking to Coney about it. Did I mention I did some...
Oh, really? Coney?
Did you? Yeah. And he said maybe Watling at 6, assuming he's fit, as he will be almost certainly, and then maybe Santa at 7, Jameson at 8, and then you can
play... But Santa's not in the squad. They've named at 15, which he's not in, so he's definitely not playing.
Off the charts then, I would imagine.
That was just what Coney told me. That was only yesterday, so he wasn't...
Okay.
Yeah,
not that then.
I can kind of see them just not playing a spinner. They've done that before.
Fiovis and Williamson, if you need it, it's pretty, yeah. Well, Butch is going to get angry. I can sense it already.
especially if you're going with Ashwin and Jadeja as well. You get two spinners and
I just want Jadeja and Patel to play in the same game of cricket. I mean, you know, the Matryoshka doll Jadeja, yeah. Isn't he? Patel, he's amazing.
Yeah, I think that prospect kind of gives England batsmen nightmares, isn't it? Mm, cool. So we've got that to look forward to this week. Joe, there's a new magazine out. What's in it?
Oh, what is in it? God, it feels like a long time ago that we did this one. Obviously, there was quite a lot going on at the time. The cover story is how do England's three emerging fast bowlers in Stone, Overton and Robinson force their way into contention. It already feels a little bit like we're behind the story on this one, but I would still urge you to pick up a copy and read the interviews.
I don't think so at all. I mean, I think obviously off-field events kind of overshadowed Robinson's performance, but from a purely cricketing point of view, his debut properly changes things.
Right, and obviously, and Anderson didn't have the best two test matches, that we're not going to fall into the trap of writing him off, but there is going to be that building pressure. All it will take is one or two more less effectual test matches and that will really come to the fore. And anyway, yeah, as you say, the way Robinson bowled on his test debut, leaving aside with other stuff, suggests he's got a long test career ahead of him. So how do you get them all in? How do you balance the side? We're not going to go down that route again, but that's the main thing we're looking at. And the other thing we're going to have some discussion about, obviously the World Test Championship final around the corner, we decided, you involved as well, Yaz, and Ben and Phil and I sat down and reworked the whole thing.
The Wisden World Test Championship.
It's utterly flawless,
yeah.
Apart from possibly some things we've missed, but it's certainly better than the one they came up with, and we're safe in the knowledge of doing that.
Yeah. That's why we did it. So sum up what the actual format is and then we'll go into why we think it's better.
Well, one of the main issues, I think the main issue with what we've had so far is that not everyone plays everyone in a cycle and teams play a different number of games. So what we've done is we've added the three test playing nations who aren't included so far, so Zimbabwe, Afghanistan, Ireland. So we've got 12 in total. Then we split them into two groups of six based on the ICC test rankings at the time of the start of the new cycle. And then within your group of six, you play each team in a three test series. So you're playing 15 test matches.
Over 2.5 years, not...
So we've extended the cycle by a year. So actually the fixture congestion, it sounds like quite a lot, but actually the fixture congestion is less than it currently is for the cycle. And then the exciting bit is...
Just before you get to the...
Sure.
With the emerging nations, Ireland, Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, four-day test matches is an option. If it suits their board and if it suits the integrity of the competition, realistically, if Ireland and India are matching up, and I think they are in Group B of our setup, then maybe four-day cricket is a more sensible way to go. It didn't feel like it was bastardising the game when Ireland played a four-day game at Lord's. I mean, they could have won that one. So there is that element to it as well. And after the first cycle, get together with all the boards and discuss if there remains any flexibility with 4 or 5 day cricket for certain games, it being incumbent on certain boards to be able to afford to put the thing on.
And we acknowledge that there will be some untidy contests, but
that's test cricket.
We feel that's test cricket. And we feel that's the only way that sides like Ireland are going to learn. If you give them full member status, then actually let them play the thing rather than exclude them from the thing, which is meant to be the thing we're all interested in. And we've also said, look, that we all know that the international schedule is packed. So this is an opportunity for, if India are playing Ireland in a three test series, if they want to play their B team, then that's fine. And I don't really subscribe to the idea that one-sided test match is going to put people off the whole thing, unless that is what dominates test cricket. And we think the tournament's got enough going for it, aside from some one-sided contest to work. And then the exciting bit is after we have two groups of six, the top two in each group then qualify for the World Test Championship finals, which is effectively like a World Cup or a T20 World Cup, but for test cricket. So you've got four teams who play a round robin against each other over 4 or 5 weeks. And then the top two teams in that round robin play each other in a big one-off final.
Over 6 days.
And I think we said, if that's a draw, then the team who topped the table in the round robin win. So there is no, unlike the current system where if it's a draw, it's just a shared trophy. And there's obviously financial implications, which Phil has gone through in detail in our piece. He solved that aspect of it.
I'm a natural economist. Absolutely. Mark, this is news to you.
Also, before you ask Butch, can I tell you a couple of other things that I like about it? So I think one of the problems with the current system is that very, very early on, you're not really quite sure what the teams at the bottom are playing for. Whereas this, A, it guarantees countries that don't play that much test cricket a certain number of test matches, but B, there's kind of a realistic kind of progression for a team like Bangladesh. So a Bangladesh might start the first competition as a fifth or fourth seed, but a couple of good results in the first cycle, they could be a third seed in the next one. And you kind of, using the football example at the moment, the Euros, you have that group of death, Portugal, France, Germany, when it didn't go so well for them. You could have that kind of situation where you have three massive teams in one group because a team like Bangladesh got a couple of surprise results, and Bangladesh can be a third seed next time round, and that's a realistic way for them to kind of get to the finals, which would be a really big deal for a team like Bangladesh, and even now a team like West Indies, for example. And I think that there is that kind of carrot for those teams to aim for that is realistic, that I like about this tournament. Obviously it's perfect. But Birch, what are your initial reactions?
What's wrong with it?
Yeah. No, I can't think of anything that's wrong with it. I mean,
12 teams,
I don't think I've ever really been sold on the idea of a test championship full stop, which is always my starting point.
Okay.
I'm very, very excited about this game coming up. Pitching the two best sides against one another. But if you have to have one, I mean, it certainly sounds like a good way of doing it. I particularly agree with the fact that that all series are three match series. I mean, it's just utter nonsense that not all teams play each other, and some teams actively refuse to have series against other sides. We're talking about you, Australia. You know, then the matches are series are played over five, they're played over three, they're played over two, and you have an extraordinary weighting for the amount of points that you can win based on the fewer test matches that you play. I mean, that frankly is nonsense. However, the two best sides in this cycle, as interrupted and as messed about as it's been, would have qualified pretty much any other way you shake it up, wouldn't they? There's New Zealand and India, so it hasn't been all bad. But yeah, I mean, look, I'm willing to give it a go. I'm willing to see. The one thing that bothers me slightly is the idea that you might have to play four-day test matches for some of the other sides. I mean, clearly, playing a game over less days gives the underdog a bit more of a chance than it would do if it was over five.
Mm. We did an R on that one, I think.
But I understand why you'd do it. I mean, the other side of that is that it kind of then encourages, Ireland had a fantastic chance of beating England for lots of reasons. One of them was it was like 4 days after the World Cup final. The other one, that the pitch was as green, was kind of a perfect sort of pitch to ambush match team. Did a bit all the way through. What they get bowled out for in the last inning? 70 or something. Well, 30, there you go. So it kind of encourages that type of thing for home teams. But there is no perfect way of doing it, and that's as good an idea as I've heard so far.
Worth saying that the ICC have changed the points format for the next cycle. So it's not done on, so every test match is worth the same number of points, and the table is done by points per game. So they have slightly changed it and probably slightly improved it.
Another crucial but potentially controversial point of this tournament is that there are bilateral series which exist outside of this tournament. So the Ashes is nothing to do with this. If you play a World Test Championship series, that's a three test series standalone thing, which we think actually rather than detracting from those series, it will mean that this, when you start a series, this is for the World Test Championship. It's not muddy waters of potentially three test matches being towards the Ashes or the whole thing being a World Test Championship and an Ashes series. When these test series come around, they are just for the World Test Championship. Everyone knows that, and everyone knows what they're for. And that means that England would play Australia in a test series, which isn't the Ashes, which, it has happened before, but might not be everyone's cup of tea, but we think it's better to separate these things and mean actually less is more in the World Test Championship. Not every series going towards it means the ones that are have a bit more hanging on it.
Just on the numbers, you'd average five test matches a year. So for Ireland, it's two or three test matches more than they would be playing. For England, it's a third of the test match schedule that they would have anyway. Same with India. They would average around that number.
So plenty of room to play the teams that aren't in your group that you would otherwise play.
That side of it's very, very good. It's very well done.
Well done, everyone. Well
Thank
done
everyone. You.
What else in the magazine do you want to shout about?
The Temba Bavuma.
Yeah.
Interviewed by Neil Manthorpe, friend of yours, brilliant, brilliant journalist, broadcaster and writer, top man, and he's on our editorial board. He's our South African correspondent, and he contributes. Anyway, he secured the Temba Bavuma interview, obviously in the midst of a chaotic time for South African cricket. He's in the slipstream, being appointed there, the limited overs captain, it's one of the most readable interviews where the quotes do the job for you. You know, Neil didn't really have to do much more than just tie them up and present them. And, you know, he's a really, really sharp, impressive geezer, is Temba Bavuma. And he's got great kind of fortitude and conscience, and you could see how much he burns for the cause, and they need these kinds of figures at the moment. He spoke about the symbolism of it, of course, but there was a lot of good gnarly cricket stuff in there, you know. And
I thought the line is
one of the best interviews we've run in a long time. I think
I thought it was interesting when he said a lot of it was a lot of the thought when he got given the captaincy. Well, is he going to be good enough to justify the captaincy given he hasn't played much white ball cricket for South Africa?
Though when he has, he's played well.
Yeah,
he's played really well.
He said the flip side is actually, well, if he's thinking about captaincy, he actually is putting less pressure on himself as an individual, and he thinks actually give him some freedom as a batsman. Now,
gives him a few games, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that it could play out very differently to that, but I thought that was an interesting way of viewing it and kind of compartmentalizing the different aspects of the role that he's got now, because it's a big job. It's one of the toughest jobs in cricket.
Yeah, big time. You can get the magazine at wisdom.com/shop, as always. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment of the week came from the Dhaka T20 Cricket League.
Obviously.
In Bangladesh, obviously. Keen follower. Shakib Al Hassan goes ballistic. If we thought he might be keeping a kind of low profile after his ban for not reporting illegal approaches, he's doing a pretty poor job of it. This was bizarre, really. There was two sort of threads to it. He has an LBW appeal against Mushfiqur Rahim, which is turned down by the umpire.
It was out.
It did look out.
But that's not the point.
He turns around, appeals, then boots the stumps over at the non-striker's end right in front of the umpire, then proceeds to kind of shout in the umpire's face. So not a great start. Noticeably, no one else kind of comes in. Everyone just sort of leaves Shakib to it. Then just an over later, a bit of rain starts to come down and the umpire decides to take the players off the field. Shakib races in from extra cover or something, furious, shouts to the umpire again, picks all three stumps out of the ground, throws them on the floor like a three-year-old, and then picks another one up and stabs it back into the ground near the umpire.
Quite understand the symbolism of that.
The game in that competition, you need six overs for result, not five. And the umpires took them off after 5.5 overs when Shakib's team was clearly going to win. So that was quite funny. They ended up coming back on the field. And Shakib's team did win. But I would... I guess you probably shouldn't do that. But you can understand his frustration for the second one more.
Exactly. My first team at my club, exactly the same thing happened earlier in the season. They took them off with one ball needed. And it's not the umpires that are taking them off, it's the captain of the team is walking the team off. Oh, it was
dear.
Chucking it down, apparently. But well, it's one ball needed for a result.
It wasn't chucking it down in this circumstance at all. So perhaps it was just one out. And there is, I've read a bit around this, and there seems to be an underlying thing of the kind of quality of umpiring in Bangladesh is poor, and there's lots of accusations of biased umpiring. So there is probably that happening beneath it. But it's quite an interesting piece by Mohammed Izam on Crick Info, talking about this is kind of the natural step for Shaggy. Basically, the Bangladesh Cricket Board have let him off the hook so many times over the years, largely because he is so much better than the rest of their players, that they always give him a bit of a ban, but then lessen that ban because they want him to come back play. And even this, they gave him a three-game ban and a fine of, I think, $6,000, which I was looking at the regulations in club cricket. I mean, that would probably be a 10-game ban in club cricket if he did what he did in English club cricket. It's not great, basically, and it's just another. I mean, he's a fascinating character and cricketer. Obviously, a brilliant cricketer, hugely valuable to Bangladesh. But also, I think there's a bit of sort of embarrassment at the guy that they've tried to give another chance, throwing his toys out of the pram quite so publicly. And obviously these days it's all on video, so you can see the whole thing on Twitter. But he rounded it off with a fantastic apology on social media, which he apologised for his human error. And then said, hopefully I won't be repeating this again. Thanks and love you all. So yeah. There are no promises there. Yeah. It might happen again next week. But
yeah. And finally, we mentioned a few weeks ago, Phil, that you spent a day with Beefy, an afternoon at Beefy's.
Going over to Beefy's house.
We'll be playing the first half of that interview today. It's about the 1981 Ashes, the build up to it and all that, which took place 40 years ago this year. Phil, briefly, your recollections of that interview?
It remains a fever dream from start to finish. Just go and listen to it.
We'll play that interview in a bit. The interview brought to us in partnership with Botham Wine to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Botham's Ashes. Everyone knows who Beefy is, obviously. What is less known about Botham is his lifelong passion for wine and the art of creating it. 40 years as an international cricketer and commentator took Botham to wineries and vineyards all around the globe in the development of his own range of wines. He worked passionately with renowned winemakers to create bespoke blends to his exacting standards. Only when a wine is good enough to go on his own table does Ian allow his name to go on the label. For more information, go to bothamwines.com. Here is the first part of that interview with Phil.
Sir Ian, thank you for inviting us into your beautiful house. 40 years on from the infamous summer of 81, you came into that summer holding the captaincy, of course, having faced the might of the West Indies that spring and, of course, the previous summer as well. That tour in itself, the early 81 tour, was at times controversial. It was obviously heartbreaking as well with the story of Kenny Barrington, who unfortunately died midway through the Barbados Test. And you were 25-year-old, managing as tough a tour as you can imagine. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, pretty much. We also had the Robin Jackman affair.
Yeah, the Guyana game.
Yeah, so it really just escalated. But we held it together pretty well as a team. Kenny was a massive blow because he was the old colonel, as we call him. He was very much part of the team, very much involved. His official title was assistant manager, I think, but as far as the team, he was our coach. And just great company. And one of the nice things about Kenny, and this is something a lesson I learned very early on, you never hear him say, "In my day." Never referred to "in my day" ever. It was always up to date. And
I spoke to Graham Gooch, actually, funnily enough, last week, and he made 100 at Barbados in the shadow of Kenny's passing. And he was quite choked up, actually, about the memory of Kenny, and it seemed that overshadowed the whole of the tour, really.
Well, I got a phone call in my room. Myself and my wife had been out, and I'd seen Kenny that evening, and we were going out, and he was going out, and it all happened in around midnight, I think 1 o'clock, something like that. And they rang me. I was captain, I suppose it was logical. They rang me at about 6:30 because they didn't want it coming from somewhere else. Someone banging on the door, a news reporter, and saying, you know, reaction to this. So I got up and went with AC up to AC Smith's room, the team room, and sat there with him, and we ummed and ahed. And I said to him, he said, "Do you want to play this test? Do you want to?" And I said, "Yeah, hang on. Look, let's think about the Colonel. He would want us to play this test. He wouldn't want us to do anything else but play. And he'd love it if we could win." So the players, we pulled the players in, told the guys, and I think just about everybody. I mean, there was a lot of tears shed.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of tears shed. It started when we all went out that next morning and we lined up the two teams. And the West Indian boys loved Kenny as well. And there's a lot of tears there, and they'd all got to know Kenny. He's that kind of person. It was a very emotional test. And you know, I think we were all loved it when Gucci got 100. It was a massive shock. And with everything else that was going on around us, we did well. And you know, at the end of the day, we lost 1-0 at home, and I think it was, which way around was it? 1-0 and 2-1, sorry, 1-0 and 2-0 over the two series, because we played them back to back. So, so consequently, the teams were quite close.
Indeed,
certain members of the team, each team was, were pretty close. And again, that's probably why it was, well, magnified by Kenny's magnified Kenny's death with both teams. It hurt both teams. So,
yeah, no doubt.
You were in charge for all of those test matches, as you mentioned. You were relatively young, comparatively young in the job, and only 3.5 years into your own test career. And you were playing one of the all-time great teams in the history of the game. Could you enjoy it? Were you fully invested in it? And obviously we'll come to what happened in the summer regarding the captaincy, but where were you against the Windies?
I was learning as I was going along, literally.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, you're coping with different situations. Players are all different. That was one of the biggest problems I had, was when someone drops the simplest of catches, you'll go and pat him on the back. Right. I go and kick him up the arse. Because I just don't get that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're applauding failure. Mm-hmm. And that's something I really, really, really have a problem with. And, I, you know, I'll be honest with you, with hindsight, maybe I should have said no. But hindsight's a very useful weapon, isn't it? You know, it's a very easy way out of things.
And you don't say no to that question, do you?
Well, 24 years of age, and you get the knock on the door and say, would like you to be captain. Well, you're not going to say no, but as I say, with hindsight, maybe if I had said no then and left it for a couple of years. But do you know what? Look, I'm a great believer in you ride the torpedo to the end of the tube. Once you start going, you go, and there's no getting off. And everything that happened, I believe, happened for a reason. And who knows, 81 might not have happened if I'd have stayed as captain and what have you. So maybe it freed me up. Let me be more expansive. Mm-hmm. And also I wasn't having to worry about all the players and how everyone was coping. And I probably better off being a sergeant major than being the general.
Okay. Well, we'll come to the general who replaced you in a moment, obviously. Rolling into that summer then, it must have been a relief in a way to be out of the pressure cooker of that West Indies tour. And then rolling into the summer, the Australians were here. Trent Bridge was the first test match. You were still in charge.
We should have won that.
And you've said this before, should have won if you caught your catches. Is that fair?
Well, yeah. And one of my most reliable catches, David Gower, dropped a skyer. And if he'd have taken that, we'd have won the game. And so, you know, but it's all ifs, if only. Sure. It doesn't happen like that in professional sports. So they scraped through. I look at it now and I think, do we deserve to win that game? Yes, I thought we did. But you know, we made up for it.
Sure. If you had won that game, history would have taken a very different path because...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy with the path I took.
I can imagine.
Yeah, quite happy with that.
What was it like to play that Australian side at the time? Because you'd have been already good friends with a number of them, right? AB was in there, of course, Rod Marsh, Dennis Lilly, Kim Hughes. These were players who not only had you come up against, but who you'd spent some good times with as well. So into that Trent Bridge game, what was the buzz like? What was the atmosphere like between the two sides?
As you'd expect, England and Australia. There's always a little bit of mud throwing from each side in the build-up, which is I always find quite amusing. But you know, you're talking about some of the greats of the game: Lilly, Marsh, mm-hmm. Border, one of the finest players I played against. Tough competitor, gutsed it out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, I think we had a lot of respect for both sides, and I've always been a big fan of Australia and Australian sport. When you think of the population they've got, I think at some stage they held men's and women's hockey, World Cup, rugby league, rugby union, cricket, mm-hmm. and probably a host of other games we've never heard of. But they are the ultimate competitors.
Yeah.
They don't know when to lie down. And I think that's why I played the game probably, some would say in those days, in sort of the Australian way. Believed in attacking rather than defending. But you know, every England cricketer, every cricketer, when he starts out, wants to play for England, for his country, or Australia, or whoever. But there's something special about England v Australia.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Poms against the convicts. Yeah, and there's a lot of good banter out there. Aggression.
Do you see something of yourself in them as well, in their temperament? Do you think that's why you've always worked so well against them?
I've also got a lot of friends in Australia. And do you know something? I think the biggest compliment I've ever had from an Australian was when they turned around, one of the guys, I think it was Kim Hughes, said in an interview, well, he's more Australian than he is bloody English. And I thought, well, that's a pretty big rap coming from an Aussie.
Yeah, yeah, you'll take
but,
that.
Yeah, but no, I've got a lot of friends over there. Normally spend about 3 months a year over there now, with the wine business, which we're tucking into here. Mm. Love to share it, but bad luck. but no, so I'm over there a lot. Great friends, very close friends, AB, and myself, DK. Mm. I've had some great nights with him in Perth. Yeah, you know, I think nowadays, I'm not sure the players have the same sort of relationship on the field that we had. Yeah, they might have a drink at the end of a game, but I think boys that are playing in something like the IPL, that you know, they'll all become good mates. But in Test series, I'm not so sure the way it was, but certainly. If we were in the field all day and you come out and it's 33 degrees and you're in Perth and you go and sit down in the dressing room, it's only a matter of minutes. You're taking your wet socks off and your wet shirt, and the Aussies are walking in with a slab of beer, and you're sitting down with a cold can. And when Tomo was playing, you'd usually get a very large amount of seafood delivered with his contacts in the fishing world. So it actually, we didn't need a match referee.
Yeah.
Because if there were anything to discuss, it was discussed there and then.
And you policed yourself.
And it was put to bed.
Yeah. Even in the absolute heat of battle, there was never any fallout into the evening or.
No, not really.
No.
No, I think, in fact, we actually mixed quite a lot. You know, go out with the wives, and you know, Jane and Alan would come out, Kath and myself. You know, one of the guys would be having a barbecue and go along, and which continued when we came over here, and the Aussies, we'd have a barbecue
on the off day of the Headingley Test.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Some, as you say, pedigree great cricketers there as well, and some other names that we could mention. Coming out of Trent Bridge, despite being one down, were you still reasonably chipper about your team's chances?
Yeah. I thought I didn't think we deserved. We should have won that game. Didn't. And then at Lord's, I went there and I started to feel not quite so happy with myself.
Okay.
Because what a lot of people didn't realise is that Alec Bedser, chairman of selectors, and his team decided to give me game by game captaincy. So I said, I thought about it at the Lord's game. And at the end of that game, I walked straight up to Alec Bedser and I said, Alec, I can't work like this. Yeah. I said, my family can't live like this. I can't work and live like this. And the team don't deserve this. And I resigned, which I thought was quite amusing, because about half an hour later, the boys got the television on in the dressing room and everyone's getting changed and having a drink at the end of the game. And Alec Bedser comes on and he said, well, he resigned, but we're going to sack him anyway. I thought, well, is that necessary? I thought, blimey.
Not the most tactful approach.
No, but that was what I was working with at that time.
And so your game was obviously marked by a kind of sense of fun and expressiveness and so on, but had that reality of a game-by-game, week-by-week role heading up the England cricket side, had it begun to chip away?
By the end of Trent Bridge, when they started the one test at a time, I thought, well, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So I was very happy in the news conference to turn around to them and say, well, there's a bloke called Mike Brearley. I think I might bring him back for the rest of the series. I said, because I think he'll be able to settle the dressing room, and because a lot of the players were on my side upset. There've been a few the other way as well, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But that's fair enough. I don't mind that at all. No, I thought I actually thought no, time to walk.
So a week later, you've identified the right person to take over. Thankfully, they've listened to you, and Mike Brearley, the great Mike Brearley, takes control of the side. What was the build-up like to Leeds the day or two beforehand?
Well, the two players, probably the most involved in that game, Bob Willis and myself, were... Bob wasn't originally picked.
Yeah.
And Brears took over and he rang him, and Bobby said, mate, I'm not playing against for Warwickshire this week to make sure I'm 100% fit for the Headingley game. And Brea said, OK, that's good enough for me. And then when I got to the ground and I stood there and he walked up to me and he said, he was always called me Both. And he said, Both, he said, are you sure you want to play this game? And I looked at him and I said, what? He said, are you sure you want to do it? And I said, Brears, who are we playing? We're playing Australia. Of course I want to play. And he said, great. He said, I think you're going to get 10 wickets and 100. You weren't far off.
No.
Weren't far off. But
he undercut you a bit on the runs.
But you know, I always remember that game because one of the reasons, apart from the obvious, but one of the other great things was that Bob, the reason they were thinking of leaving him out, the selectors, was because he bowled too many no balls. Well, at Headingley, he didn't bowl one no ball in either innings, and 14.3 or whatever overs it was, he bowled off the reel coming down the hill when I let him come down the hill. And he came down the hill, 8 for 43, one of the greatest fast bowling spells I've seen. Mm. And to keep going, but we couldn't talk to him because he goes into that tunnel where my torpedo goes. That tunnel, he goes there, and he was just focused on doing what he does best, and that's bowling as quick as he can and taking wickets. And he would take the wicket, there'd be a little bit of a pat on the back, and then by the time you look round, he's all halfway back and at the end of his run, almost at the top of the ground at Headingley, and he's waiting for the next Aussie to get out there. And I said to the guys, I said, just leave him.
Yeah.
Just leave him.
Well, we'll come to the finale in a wee bit. There's one or two other points of business to get to before we get to Bob's afternoon. The Brearley story is just a little glimpse into the way that he worked with individuals. But how did he work specifically with you? And he's spoken, obviously, very warmly about the benefits that you brought to him on the pitch and off it. That you enabled him to be a bit more freed up, to loosen him up a little bit, to enjoy the game more than he had done in his early years. How did it work the other way? What did he bring to you?
I think the biggest thing that Brears brings to you... He knows exactly what to say, when to say it. And I've been asked many, many times, and I said the best way of describing it is a little bit like, if you ever watch Star Trek, Spock. Right. Yeah, Spock, I'm a bit of a Trekkie.
But, I never saw that coming.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a Trekkie. But Spock, it was just like Brears, you felt like how I think they wanted Spock to be portrayed. Mm-hmm. Maybe they got the idea from Brears. But he could look into you, and I think he was reading your mind. Mm. And you felt like he was probing. Mm. And obviously it didn't take too long up here to work it out. But he did. He got the best out of the players. And I think he treated everyone differently, accordingly.
Yeah.
And that in itself is quite a massive achievement, to be honest. There's a lot of complicated characters out there. And he was brilliant at it. And... You know, nowadays they probably wouldn't even play Brears. They'd say he's not a good enough batsman. But you know what? I'd pick him just for that those moments of magic when he just produced something, and more often than not, his idea came off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's a special guy, and much respect for him.
Do you still chat much?
Yeah, when I see him, he hasn't been 100% just recently, and I'm not working with Sky anymore. I've retired from the commentary box. And so I don't see him as much, don't see him at the games because I'm not at the games. Mm-hmm. The only games I really go to now are Durham and England up here in the north.
Sure.
As chairman of Durham, which I love the job. But yeah, Brears, when I do bump into him, it's great. I love it.
Yeah.
And Cathcart has a lot of time for Brears as well. He was very good to the family.
Right.
Good man.
Australia batted first in that one, 400 odd for nine. I think declared you picked up six for though. And I remember on the commentary, because I've watched the video inside out, they were saying that there was a new spirit about your game. And that might be an easy way of summing it up, but was that fair?
Yeah, I think the shackles were off.
Yeah.
I think I was getting burdened, bogged down, perhaps is a better word, with the captaincy. And also with what was going on off the field. The kids got abused at school. Oh, your dad's rubbish, and all this. And Liam got into a couple of scrapes, and he's only bloody this high.
Sure.
And people can be cruel.
Yeah.
And kids in the playground, exceptionally, which we've all witnessed and seen in our years, but that was unnecessary. And it was quite nice, really, just to ram it back down a lot of people's throats.
Yeah.
And I did enjoy that aspect, I have to be honest.
You made a 50-odd in the first dig, but England failed to avoid the follow-on. And then I think we were naught for one overnight. I think Gucci had probably had his front pad blown off.
Yeah, Terry Alderman probably, yeah.
Yeah. Famously, most of the team checked out of their hotel, assuming that the game would be done that following day. You walked out maybe just after lunch, middle of the afternoon. 100-odd for five, I think. Mm. Obviously still a long way behind, and soon that was 130 for seven, still 90-something behind when Graham Dilley joined you.
Yeah, picker.
Yeah, take it from there.
Sadly no longer with us.
Yeah.
But he walked out, picker, and he came out there. And people don't realise he was a big lad, tall, well-built, strong lad. And he came out and he stood there and he said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, enjoy yourself. Yeah. I said, I'm going to. Enjoy yourself. Look, it wasn't the greatest wicket. People have to remember this. It was a pretty average wicket. And he had a bit of luck. He had a bit of luck. I had a bit of luck. He played some shots that Graham Pollock would have been proud of. The best knock I've ever seen him play. And I played a lot of cricket with Worcester together. And he was quite magnificent.
It's fascinating how it works like that, isn't it?
One
day you play on a different plane to all other...
The Aussies, he'll nick it, he'll nick it. And he did, yeah. Out the middle of the bat to the boundary through extra cover more often than not. We enjoyed ourselves, and there was a lot of good banter out there between us, and we both enjoyed watching the old Aussies getting a bit frustrated, angry.
Was it ever going through your mind, and the scene that I remember is going back to Breers as well, and others, Boykson as well, on the balcony pointing at you to stay there towards the back end of the day when maybe the mood
saying to me.
No, okay.
No, you wanted to say to Chris Hull.
Yeah, sorry.
So he said to Chris, and he's pointing at Chris Hull, and then he said to me.
Right, right.
And you know what? I didn't, because he was playing well, and I wasn't going to make him do anything different or tell him to do anything different, because he did well.
Yeah.
And, the Aussies got stuck into him, but he hung in there.
Yeah. 29, I think Chris Hull got, which gets lost in the narrative, but without that, there wouldn't have been...
Well, there was a partnership.
Yeah.
A partnership, and it was more time the Australians were in the field.
Yeah.
The pitch is not getting any better. So he did a great job. And, everyone chipped in, really, with the lower order.
Yeah.
Everyone hung around as long as they could. I mean, they were a pretty good, very formidable, actually, bowling attack the Aussies had. But didn't really have a spinner in that game, and that might have been a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there again, why would you? The pitch was doing all sorts of, again, hindsight. But
was there ever a moment in that innings, and I think you're 1-4-5 not out at the end of that day, but towards the back end of the day, were you starting to think, do you know what, something miraculous might actually be on the cards here?
Once we got to 100 ahead, I said, we're in this
all
the way. I said, this pitch is not good. And the Aussies, of course, we got rolled out, and then the Aussies came in, and then they were... I got Wood out early on.
Yeah.
Graham Wood, and then they were 50-odd for one.
Yeah, needing 80.
And Bob got the end he wanted. And the rest, they say, is history.
You said earlier you can't think of many better spells than that. One element that makes it so much more fascinating and dramatic is that he felt he was bowling for his career.
I think Bob actually... just about every game at that time of his career, with the injuries he'd had, he just felt that I've got to make the most of this. And he was running in beautifully, no balls. It was all there.
It's a little bit like Phil Mickelson whacking it down the fairway yesterday.
Stunning, all the way through.
But it was like that. It just all came together for Bob. And I think every game he was worried that he's going to wake up the next morning and that's it. The knee's gone. It's finished. It's done. So he kept going. And but fair play to him. He had a lot of painful nights after bowling.
Just going through it then, Kim Hughes nicks off for a duck, I think, and you take him at second slip. And then Graham Yallop, I think, goes for not many.
Yeah, got caught by Gap.
Yeah, a short leg. And suddenly it's on. I think lunch comes at that point. Yeah. And are you regrouping? Is it a case of sitting around having stern team talks or just
cracking on? We were actually very relaxed in the dressing room.
Right.
We felt, well, come on, boys. Got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And Bob was chomping at the bit to get back out there.
Right.
And
have you ever seen him like this before? This
not as intense as he was that game.
Yeah.
Not that innings.
Yeah.
I haven't. I'll always remember just staring. He was looking straight through me, and I thought, I'm your mate, remember? Right. But he was just tunnel vision. All he wanted to do was knock the next Australian batsman over.
Yeah. Dennis Lilly came out and uppercut a couple and threatened for a moment.
Yeah, he had a little partnership there with
Ray Bright.
Ray Bright, yeah. And Gat, I think Gat took that great catch running in, but I think he thought it was a pork pie. But he dived in and took that gat, and then I thought, right, we've won.
Yeah.
There was always going to be a little bit of resistance down the order because, DK wasn't going to block it and hang around, so he tried to be as aggressive as when he plays his best cricket, when he's aggressive with the bat.
Yeah.
And when we got him, I was pretty confident, and then Bob knocked Ray Bright's middle stump out the ground and let it all begin.
What a great moment that was. Bustling Bob's famous interview on the balcony afterwards with the Yorkshire faithful down there, and he gave him the evil eye and delivered one of the great press match, post-match interviews, but I wouldn't have fancied being on the end of it, let's put it that way.
Well, do you know, I think he answered everything. I think it was all one-word answers, as I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, did that come from a sense of the press having given him a hard time and the sense of the walls caving in somewhat?
I think there was a few of us that were pretty... I remember there was the press waiting for me down the stairs and I actually wrapped a towel around and just walked straight past him.
Right.
And I said, yeah, they're all to write. You know, we all just said the same thing. You know, you wrote what you wanted last week, well, keep on writing.
Yeah.
But then that settles down. You know, that was just, I think it's probably as much as anything, it was the adrenaline that was pumping through us all at that stage. Mm-hmm. But there was many funny things that happened in that dressing room that evening because the dressing room attendant, which I think most people have heard this, but it's absolutely true. The dressing room attendant was a young lad called Ricky Roberts, who was South African. And he was 14 years of age, and he was our dressing room attendant running around. And I got on really well with him and sat down with him and chatted away and had a coffee. And he would make me a coffee in the mornings, and we'd sit down. And I was intrigued, you know, wanted to play golf for a career, but he said, I love cricket. Anyway, end of the match. So get some champagne, and they said, well, there isn't any champagne in the pavilion. Okay, where is it? So, well, the Australians have got it in their bath, thinking they were going to be celebrating a victory. So I said to Ricky, just go over to the dressing room. In those days, they're opposite each other. I said, just knock on the door and just say to the Aussies, look, you know, can the England boys have your champagne because you won't be needing it. And he did.
14-year-old kid.
He went over and knocked on the door. Right. And all I can see was Ray Bight and Rod Marsh, I think it was, as Ricky came flying back through the door. But we stayed mates. We're still good mates now, Ricky. He went on. He was carried the bag of Ernie Elster, 3 major titles.
God, I'd heard the name. That's him.
Yeah, so he was carrying. I see Ricky quite a lot now, and with Ernie, and reminisce about that moment. Yeah, forgiven me now, I think. But he did. He came through horizontal.
Phil, cheers. Joe, cheers. Cheers, Butch. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Enjoy the show. Tell your friends and leave us a nice review in the podcast app. Cheers.